We were getting further into 1 Samuel, and the last third or so of 1 Samuel records a period in David's life when he is on the run from King Saul. Saul has gone into a demonic, envious, murderous fit of rage, and he will stop at nothing as he tries to hunt David down and kill him. It's been established in the previous chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 20, that David must flee. And so that's what David is doing. And in these chapters, at the end of 1 Samuel, we see he really goes from one crisis to another. David's life is full of narrow escapes. We've already seen that. It's going to continue. His life moves from one hardship to another. He's got to leave behind his people and his place. He's got to leave behind friends and family. He's about to become a refugee living on the run. And as he flees into the wilderness, and as he lives in the wilderness, David is going to escape one threat only to find another form of danger waiting for him. That's what it is, just one trial after another. This is an extended period of suffering and humiliation for David. Maybe you can relate. Maybe you think your life sometimes feels like that too, like it's just one trial after another. David has been anointed as king in waiting, but now he is a fugitive. The king-to-be is now the king on the run. During this period of his life, David will write at least 7 psalms. We will look at those psalms when we get to the associated events in this period of David's life. So as we go, we'll work those psalms in to the preaching schedule. And so really it's interesting when you think about 1 Samuel and then the Psalms that go with it, we really get 2 perspectives on the events that take place in this part of David's life. We get the author of 1 Samuel giving us the historical account, the historical perspective on what happened. And then in the Psalms, in the book of Psalms, David gives us an insider's point of view, what it was like to actually experience these things and to call upon God in the midst of these trials. I said that this period of suffering for David takes up about a third of 1 Samuel, and it's interesting, if you look at the Gospels, Jesus, of course, has his period of suffering too, what we call his Passion Week. That takes up about a third of each of the Gospels. So a third of 1 Samuel devoted to David's suffering, about a third of the Gospels devoted to Jesus' suffering, his Passion Week. I don't think that's a coincidence. It's really interesting to think about this. On the one hand, this period of David's life looks backwards in Israel's history, especially to the Exodus. Think of the Exodus. Israel has been in slavery, and Israel escapes Pharaoh, only to find a long period of struggle and trial in the wilderness. It'll be the same thing for David. He escapes Saul only to find himself in the wilderness enduring one trial after another. But when Israel went into the wilderness, what did God do for them? God gave the Israelites bread from heaven. When David heads out into the wilderness, he gets heavenly bread as well. We're supposed to see these connections and understand that David is Israel in himself. He is the anointed one, the one that sums up the nation in himself. He represents and embodies the covenant people of God in himself. He is reliving Israel's history, reliving Israel's experience, so he will be prepared to be Israel's king. David fulfills the Exodus and wilderness pattern. But this period of David's life doesn't just look backwards in Israel's history. It also points forward. And of course, it points forward to Jesus, the greater David. David has a season of suffering, and that season of suffering in David's life points ahead to Jesus' much greater suffering. David is a type, a prefiguring of the one to come. As David endures great trial and suffering, what is God doing in his life? David is being shaped and formed and molded into a mature man, ready for the weight of glory that comes with the throne, ready for the weight of glory that comes with the crown. The suffering he endures comes with his anointing. It's part of the territory that comes with being anointed. If you're anointed by God, God set you apart for a special role. That means God is going to give you suffering to prepare you for it. Of course, the ultimate case of this is Jesus himself. The book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus was crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, because he tasted death for everyone. Hebrews tells us Jesus was made perfect through his suffering. He learned obedience through his suffering. Jesus was sinless, and yet still somehow God used suffering in his life to mature him, to perfect him. How much more then we who are sinful like David, how much more do we need to go through the refining fires of suffering? See, suffering played this role of bringing Jesus to maturity. It's going to play that role in David's life as well. And of course, David's life foreshadows that. You can think of it this way. The text of 1 Samuel is about the life of David. And the life of David is about Jesus. David's life of suffering leading to exaltation is a template. It's a pattern for the true Messiah, Jesus, to fulfill. Jesus is great David's greater son. Jesus, like David, doesn't look like much of a king for most of his life. But that period of humiliation and suffering was paving the way for exaltation. Again, David's life is the pattern for Jesus' life. Jesus even picks up on this in the gospel lesson we read from Matthew chapter 12, where Jesus compares this episode in his own life, in his own ministry, with this incident here in 1 Samuel chapter 21. The issue in Matthew chapter 12 is really not the technicalities of gleaning laws or the technicalities of Sabbath keeping. Yes, there is. We do learn there, of course, that there's a sense in which the law is about mercy. So interpretations of the law that are contrary to that are problematic. That's certainly one of the things happening there. But the real issue in Matthew chapter 12, the real issue with the Pharisees, the real issue between Jesus and the Pharisees is Jesus' identity as the new David. That's what's at stake in the conflict with the Pharisees there. If Jesus is the new David, then everything he's doing makes sense. Now, chapters 21 and 22, we have four scenes, and obviously we're not looking at all of them this morning. We'll just look at the first two. But in these two chapters, they form a section, and there are four scenes. The first and the fourth sections deal with the priests at Nob. The second and the third sections, the inside sections, involve David's two enemies, the Philistines and Saul. Like David, Jesus faces enemies within and without. You could say Jesus faces Jewish and Gentile enemies in his ministry. Same thing with David. He's got a Jewish enemy and he's got Gentile enemies. Like David, Jesus faces false accusation and betrayal. Like David, Jesus goes through a time when he has no place to lay his head. Like David, Jesus' identity is recognized more by opponents and outsiders than it is by those close to him. The out-group recognizes who Jesus is more than the in-group, and that's how it was with David. This morning we are looking at chapter 21. And in this chapter, David flees. Again, he's got to get out of Saul's reach. But how can he avoid one of those out of the frying pan, into the fire kinds of situations? There's no situation so bad that it can't be made worse. David's in a really bad situation. How does it not become an even worse situation? Where could David possibly go that would be safe? What can David do in these circumstances? Well, think about it. If you had to flee for your life because a tyrant was hunting you down to kill you, is there any place you'd want to stop on your way out of town? Anything you'd want to stop off and do before leaving town for good? We see here what David wanted to do. David wanted to go to the house of God. David wanted to go and worship. As he heads out of Israel, he stops off at the place of worship, the place where the people would go to meet God. He goes to the tabernacle. David is losing his own house, and so he goes to God's house. Remember back in chapters 4 and 5, the tabernacle was destroyed and the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines. The Ark was eventually returned, and the Ark is still there at this point in the story at Kiriath Jearim. A new tabernacle of sorts, at least a partial tabernacle, has been built. The Ark of the Covenant is not housed there, but this new tabernacle is set up at Nob, and that's where the priests are ministering on behalf of the people. If David goes to the tabernacle, it must be because he wants to draw near to God. He wants to worship God at the tabernacle one more time before leaving Israel. Of course, he also needs provisions and a weapon. He wants God's food and God's weaponry to help him along the way. The next chapter indicates he may have also gone to God's house to get guidance. He may have gone there to inquire of the Lord. So he goes to get wisdom. What does David want as he's heading out of town? Food, weapons, and wisdom. These are things he needs. These are things all of us need. And David knew where to seek them. As he comes to the tabernacle, the priest Ahimelech trembles with fear. He can tell something's not quite right. We're not told why. We're not told what Ahimelech is thinking. Maybe it's a premonition of what's going to happen in the next chapter. Maybe he's just concerned because David is alone. And that's the first question he asks. He wants to know, why is David alone? Usually someone of David's stature, of someone of David's status would travel with an entourage, a group of men. Something must be wrong if David is traveling by himself. David answers, he says, "The king has ordered me on some business and said to me, 'Do not let anyone know anything about the business.'" And then David adds, "I have directed my young men to such and such a place." In other words, I've got men with me, I've got an entourage, they're just in a secret location because this is a secret mission. This is secret business I'm doing for the king. This is brilliant on David's part, because on the one hand, if it's a secret mission, of course Ahimelech is going to want to help with that. Who would not want to help with a secret mission? On the other hand, because it's a secret, Ahimelech can't ask any questions. So this is a great way for David to frame the issue. Now, the question is asked here, is David lying to Ahimelech? Some have said that, perhaps he's telling the truth here. There's a way that you could spin his words to say he's telling the truth. After all, the king who sent him on this mission could be understood as Yahweh rather than Saul, since the Lord Yahweh is king over Israel, and certainly he has sent David away in secrecy. The last chapter established that. So maybe you could take these words of David and put a true interpretation upon them. Perhaps. I think that's probably a bit too clever. I think David does mislead Ahimelech here. I do think this is deception. David is at war, and so he's living under the rules of warfare, where deception in certain cases is lawful. I think David's intentions in this are good. David knows that eventually Saul will come questioning Ahimelech about David, and David is intentionally keeping Ahimelech in the dark for his own good, so that when Saul comes and questions him, Ahimelech can honestly say he doesn't know what David is up to. This is going to give Ahimelech plausible deniability. Now, if you read ahead, you find out the plan doesn't work. In fact, it backfires in a horrific way. But I think that's what David is doing. What we find in the next chapter is that David greatly underestimated the lengths of wickedness to which Saul would go. He greatly underestimated Saul's hatred. And this ends in disaster for Ahimelech and the other priests, because they're going to be accused of aiding and abetting a known criminal, because, of course, that's how Saul sees David. In verse 3, David says, "What do you have on hand?" And he asks for 5 loaves to be put in his hand. The priest says, "There is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread if the young men have kept themselves from women," that is, from their wives. Normally, this bread would be reserved only for the priests, but Ahimelech is willing to share it if David and his men have the proper ceremonial status. David says, "Women have been kept from us for 3 days. Obviously, sexual union within marriage is good, but in terms of the symbolism of the old covenant, where everything that comes from within, everything that flows out of you from within, makes you unclean because you've got death inside of you. That has to do with all the cleanness laws and in the old covenant law, the holiness code, all of that. You can read about this in Leviticus 15. To really explain it would take another sermon in itself, so I won't say anything more about that. But just know that this has to do with obeying the holiness code or the cleanness laws of the old covenant, and it's all there in Leviticus if you want to go look it up. The priest gives David 5 loaves of the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord, from before the face of the Lord. This holy bread will become David's daily bread for quite a while because these loaves were actually rather large. Now, all this may seem a little bit puzzling. What's going on here? So I want to see if I can fill in what would have been understood by the original audience, but perhaps is not so clear to us. In ancient Israel, all men who went to war became Nazarites. Maybe you've heard about the Nazarite vow. You can, again, this would be another sermon in itself, but you can read about the Nazarites in Numbers chapter 6. To be a Nazarite is to be on a mission for God. To be a Nazarite is to be a holy warrior who's doing God's work in a special way. Some men, like Samson and John the Baptist, were Nazarites their whole lives. But men could also take temporary Nazarite vows. Anytime they engaged in some kind of special warfare, they would take these vows. And so they would refrain from sex, as we've already seen about. You know, think about in 2 Samuel, when Uriah is out on the battlefield, and Uriah is called in by David, and he goes home, but he does not sleep with Bathsheba. Why? Because he's under a holy war vow. He keeps himself from his wife, because that's what you did when you were under these vows and engaged in warfare. That's what David is saying about himself and his men here. He's basically saying, we are Nazarites, we are holy warriors, and we are keeping our vows. That's one piece of the puzzle you need to understand. David is under a Nazarite vow, and that means he and his fellow soldiers are in an elevated state of holiness according to the Old Covenant holiness code. But that brings us to the issue of the bread itself. What is this bread? This is the show bread, or the bread of presence, or the face bread. This is another piece of the puzzle. This is holy bread, the bread that was kept before the very face of God in the presence of God. And if you look at the law of Moses, you will see that there were 12 loaves, obviously for the 12 tribes of Israel, 12 loaves of this bread kept in the tabernacle before God's presence. Or again, literally, before the face of God. It's actually called the bread of the presence, or the face bread, because that's where it is. It's in the presence of God. It's before the face of God. Because it is holy bread, because it's set before God's face, there are special instructions for who can eat this bread, even how this bread would be made, and also who can eat it. You can find this in Leviticus chapter 24. The law says because it's holy bread, it can only be eaten by the priests, who are, of course, holy in a special way as well. The bread is kept in a place where only the priests can go in the tabernacle. So only the priests have access to this bread. Again, the bread is holy because it's in God's presence. It's near to God. And so it can only be eaten by holy men who minister in God's presence. Okay, you can be very thankful we're not under that kind of system. We're not under that whole system anymore. But that was the system they were living under. Now, you can probably see how all this comes together. Nazarites, for the duration of their vow, were in an elevated state of holiness. It's kind of like when you're under a Nazarite vow, it's almost like you're a priest. They're holy like priests are holy. So David and his men, they're not just ceremonially clean, they are ceremonially holy. And David comes asking for holy bread. And this is why Ahimelech is willing to give holy bread to David and to his men. They are in this state of holiness because they are Nazarites, and so this holy bread can be shared with them. This is holy bread for holy men. And further, it seems all of this takes place on the holy day, on the Sabbath. Because again, under the Old Covenant, every Sabbath, the 12 loaves would be taken out, eaten by the priests, and replaced with 12 fresh loaves. Verse 6 indicates this is the day to change out the bread, so it must be a Sabbath. And I think David knew all of this. He shows up just in time to think, okay, they'll be changing out the bread. I should be able to get some of that bread since I am a holy warrior for the Lord. What about the 5 loaves? Why the number 5? Why not just ask for all 12? Well, maybe it's because David has 4 companions at this point, so there are 5 of them all together. Or maybe it's because 5 is the number associated with military formation in the Old Testament. This shows up many times in the Old Testament, though translations don't always capture it. There's actually another Exodus connection here. In Exodus chapter 13, this is right after the Exodus, right after the Red Sea crossing. And so when the Israelites came out of Egypt, Exodus 13 tells us they were marching in fives, in groups of five. Five in a rank, or maybe five squadrons together. They came out of Egypt in a military formation, and these military formations are always numbered by fives. And of course, Israel came out in military formation because Israel as a whole was God's war camp. Israel as a whole at that point was God's holy army. My guess is that David has four men with him, and so they are marching out of Israel, five in a rank, in military formation. And David comes asking for five loaves of holy bread, so each of these holy men will get one loaf for the journey. So again, all of this is part of David's exodus. Again, think about Israel. When Israel came out of slavery in Egypt, they came out in fives. And what did God do for them? God gave them holy bread. God gave them heavenly bread. The manna that fell from heaven. The tabernacle, of course, is heaven on earth. It is an architectural heaven, a model of heaven set in the midst of the people on earth. When David gets that holy bread, it's like he's getting manna from heaven. This is the bread of the presence, the bread that comes from heaven itself, from the very presence of God. See, God is doing the same thing for David that he did for Israel. If David could have been satisfied with ordinary bread, he could have just gone around asking and surely would have found somebody who would give him bread. After all, this is the guy that killed Goliath. There'd be lots of people happy to share bread with him. But David wanted God's bread. He wanted communion with God. And so he went to the house of God. See, other gods demand that their people feed them. Our God graciously feeds us. David knows that, so he goes to God's house for bread. David then has another request. He asks if there is a sword or spear on hand. And he, again, with a mild deception, he says that the king's business required him to leave in such haste that he could not take his own weapons. That's not exactly the truth. The priest responds saying, "The sword of Goliath, whom you killed, is behind the ephod. Take it." Ahimelech seems to indicate here that the sword of Goliath rightfully belongs to David. He even recounts the history because David killed Goliath in the valley with that very sword. And so, of course, David can take it. But again, there's a detail here you need to notice. The sword is behind the ephod. The ephod is part of the priestly uniform. It could mean that Ahimelech is carrying the sword himself and has it wrapped up in his priestly garment, in his priestly ephod. It could be that the sword gets stored in the tabernacle with the ephod, with priestly garments that are kept there. Whatever the case, the sword is in the tabernacle, which is a holy place, and it is associated with priestly clothing, that is to say, with holy clothes. The sword is in a holy environment. The sword has been consecrated to God. It is now God's sword. The sword has been brought to the place where God is present. Goliath's sword is consecrated. It is a holy sword. And so think about all that's happening here in this first scene. David goes to the place of worship as he's heading out of town. He wants one last Sabbath service before becoming a refugee and a fugitive outside the land. David comes to a holy place on a holy day, and he has this Nazirite holy war status. David gets a meal with God, holy bread that's been in God's presence. He gets a holy weapon, a holy sword that the priests have consecrated and kept with the priestly uniform as if it's now part of a priestly uniform. What's happening here? God's man gets God's food and God's weapon on God's day so he can go do God's business. That's what's happening here. Now, there's one more little detail to notice before moving on. It seems like everything is going so well. Everything is working out for David, but there is a catch. Right there in the middle of this scene, in verse 7, we find a man named Doeg. His name ominously means worry or anxiety. That's what Doeg means. Ominously, also, he is referred to as a servant of Saul, or more accurately, as it turns out, we could say he is a spy for Saul. He was there at the tabernacle when this is taking place. It seems that he was being detained at the tabernacle for some reason. We're told that he is an Edomite. That means he is a descendant of Esau. They are known for being enemies of the Israelites. He is Saul's chief herdsman, so that's really where his loyalties will be within Israel, with Saul. And he notices all of these proceedings, and in the next chapter, he's going to take the information he has gleaned from this event, and he's going to use it to blow David's cover, to make false accusations against David and against Ahimelech and indeed all the other priests at Nob. Doeg is an exceedingly wicked man. It's not surprising that Saul, a bloodthirsty man, would want Doeg, another cruel and bloodthirsty man, in his service. And because of Doeg's false accusations, the unarmed priests at Nob will be murdered in the next chapter. We're going to see that David's attempt to protect Ahimelech, to give him plausible deniability, to make it so Ahimelech can say, "No, I wasn't helping David in the way you think." None of that is going to work because of Doeg's treachery. But that's looking ahead to the next chapter. David leaves Nob in verse 10. It says he fled that day away from Saul. So again, all of this is about getting away from Saul. But he goes to a very surprising place for his next stop. He goes into the territory of King Achish in the city of Gath. Israel has become enemy territory for David, but Gath is certainly enemy territory as well. Gath, after all, is a Philistine city. Not only that, it should sound familiar to you. Gath is the city Goliath was from. He was Goliath of Gath. So you might ask, why would David go straight into enemy territory in this way? Isn't this making a bad situation worse? Saul is after David, but David is also the main enemy of the Philistines as well. David's been killing Philistines consistently, including Goliath, of course, in the Valley of Elah. But he's killed many other Philistines too, including killing 200 and then circumcising their corpses in chapter 18. Nothing could have been more humiliating for Philistines than that. And David did it as a bride price. He's not only defeated and killed Philistines, he has humiliated them. And so Saul may be going around Israel, hanging up most wanted posters with David's face on them, but the Philistines want David as well. Think about this. As David goes into Gath, there are widows and orphans in Gath because David killed their men. He's not going to be welcome there. And on top of that, he's going to enter the city, quite possibly with Goliath's sword. What is he thinking? Is he going there because it's the one place Saul would not think to look for him? The last place Saul would expect him to be? That may be part of it. Is he hoping to enter into the city and not be recognized by the Philistines? And so he can hide there for a while he regroups and tries to figure out what to do next. The problem with that, of course, is that if they do recognize him, Achish is going to want to kill him just like Saul would. This is a risky move on David's part. We're not told why he went there. Whatever the reason for going there, all we can say is that for David, desperate times called for desperate measures. This is a truly desperate man with no place to go. Whatever David's motivations were, whatever his thoughts were, it did not work. As soon as David gets into the town of Gath, the servants of Achish recognize him. They recognize him immediately. But there are two things that are interesting about verse 11. The Philistines refer to David as the king of the land, that is, the king of the land of Israel. Remember, Saul referred to David with contempt as the son of Jesse. Saul wouldn't even say David's name. They refer to David as the king of the land. They're already thinking of David as king over Israel. Is this because David's had so much success, or because they know David's been anointed and is the successor? We're not told how they arrived at this conclusion, but notice this. Think about this in relationship to the ministry of Jesus. Just as the demons recognized Jesus for who he was when hardly anyone else did, so these pagan Philistines know David's identity better than the Israelites. The out-group recognizes the Messiah when the in-group won't. Not only that, but they also remember the song that was sang about David back in chapter 18 after he defeated Goliath. This hit song, you know, that was so popular in Israel, singing about how Saul's killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. It was so popular in Israel, they've even heard it in Gath. Even the Gathites know this song. Now I'm thinking David probably hated that song himself by this point. All that song has done is cause him trouble, stirring up Saul's envy, and now becoming an issue for him in Gath. And we're told David is afraid. Note that David was afraid. He had reason to be afraid. Okay, courage is not the absence of fear. It is when you are afraid and you do the right thing anyway. David is afraid of what Achish will do to him. Well, David gets really resourceful here. David is captured and apparently imprisoned. David gets really resourceful and clever. He begins to act like a madman, like he's gone insane. Once again, David is using deception, and this time it will work. David's quick on his feet. He was shrewd. He was cunning in a good way. He's innocent as a dove, wise as a serpent. This is a good example of what that means. It's interesting. Saul really is a madman. David pretends to be a madman. David acts like he's crazy. And David must have been a pretty good actor because he fools them. You know, David's got this Swiss Army-like set of skills. We can add this to the list. Amongst all the other things David was good at, he was also good at acting. At least he was good at acting like he was crazy. Again, it seems he's been locked up. He begins scratching at the door of the gate. He's drooling all over his beard. And so there he is. He's in jail. He is defenseless. He's desperate. He's awaiting Achish to decide his fate. Achish is probably trying to think up some way to kill him that will be as painful and torturous as possible. And so David figures his only way out is to plead insanity. Acting like he's insane is his best shot. And so in verses 14 and 15, Achish has one of the all-time great lines from a political ruler. He says, look, this man is insane. Why did you bring him to me? Don't I already have enough madmen? Why should I house this fellow as well? Achish says, the insane asylum is already full. I've got enough madmen who are already dependent upon me. I'm already housing enough of them. I certainly don't need one more. And so David is released. David is able to escape. And at the start of chapter 22, David goes to the cave of Adullam. He continues to flee, looking for a safe place to land. He goes to the cave of Adullam. You should note that when David was imprisoned in Gath, he wrote Psalm 56, crying out to the Lord for help. When he leaves Gath, he writes Psalm 34. He pens this psalm to celebrate his deliverance after God got him out of yet another jam. So we'll look at those two psalms sometime soon. Now that's 1 Samuel 21. We have to ask, what good does a story like this do for us? Well, I think it does us a lot of good because many of us find ourselves in situations much like David, situations where we are in distress and it feels like darkness is covering us, situations where it feels like we're running out of options and there's nowhere else to turn. It feels like everything is arrayed against us. We start to feel like circumstances are squeezing in every possible direction. Things are closing in on us. That was David. And what did David do? Well, again, David turned to the Lord. He went to the house of the Lord. When David had to flee, his first stop was the house of God. David is going to seek God where God has promised to be found. David is going to seek God's gifts where God has promised to offer them. He's going to seek God's presence where God has promised to be. For David, the showbread is really his version of the Lord's Supper. The showbread is God's gift. To eat that bread is to know God's presence and God's peace. And that's what David wants. He wants communion with God. This is his communion meal. It's really interesting. We'll talk about this more. But in Psalm 34, written in the aftermath of this chapter, David says, I sought the Lord, and he heard me. He delivered me from all my fears. He goes on, he writes, taste and see that the Lord is good. Imagine David chomping down on his showbread, chomping down on that bread of the presence, saying, taste and see that the Lord is good. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who trusts in him. That's Psalm 34. It goes on. Those who fear him lack nothing. They lack no good thing. Imagine having lost everything. You know, having to give up your people and your place. Imagine losing your family and your friends. Imagine losing your wealth and your status. Losing everything. And then being able to say to the Lord in prayer, I lack nothing because God is with me. We want to say, now, David, you're lacking a few things here. No, David is saying, because I have God, I lack nothing. David is saying, God is my greatest joy and my treasure. For David, the showbread strengthened him for the journey ahead. Now, we don't have a tabernacle in Nob to go to. We don't have showbread. In just the same way. We're not under that whole system of cleanness and uncleanness and holiness that they were under. We've got something much, much better. We are all God's holy ones. We've all been anointed in our baptisms. We've been set apart by God in our baptisms and made part of his holy war camp, his holy people. We have the church, the gathering of God's people. Jesus says, whenever two or three people gather in his name, under the oversight of elders, whenever two or three gather as the church, he has promised to be with them in a special way. Jesus is here with us this morning, and he's here with us to give us his gifts, indeed to give us himself. He gives us a bread that is better than the showbread, the bread of the Eucharist. He says to us, this is my body, take and eat. We too can taste and see that the Lord is good. We can be assured that all Jesus did in his living and dying and rising again and reigning, that all of that is for us. We can know his presence and his peace. We seek God's face. We seek God's gifts. We seek God's favor. We seek his strength. We seek his wisdom in many different ways. There's no question about that. But we especially seek and find these things by gathering as a holy people in his holy presence on this holy day to hear his holy word and eat from his holy table. We are the church. We've been anointed in baptism. We've been made into his royal priesthood. We are a kingdom of priests. We are his holy warriors sent on a mission by the King of Kings. We are his Nazarites. We gather on his holy day, the Lord's Day, the first day of the week, to renew covenant with him as we eat his holy bread. And so no matter your circumstances, no matter how hard life gets, no matter how much trials and struggles in life might seem to be closing in on you, whether it's a family crisis or a health crisis or a financial crisis, no matter what it is, like David, we can have confidence in God's goodness. We can taste and see that the Lord is good. We can know God has promised us ultimate deliverance. When you're on the run, when you are on the run from trials, the best place to run to is God's house, to break bread with God. There's nothing better than that. Before you face the battle, before the fight, we are called to God's house to be fed and armed for battle. David went to God's house for food and weapons, to get fed and equipped so he would be ready for the trials to come and to face the dangers all around him. In times of distress, what should we do? We should be like David. Seek the Lord where he has promised to be found. Seek the Lord where he has promised to be present in his word and in his sacraments amongst his people. Seek the Lord where he has promised to be found. God is a God with those who trust him. God is a God who is with those who trust in him. God is a God to the desperate who cry out to him. God is a God who gives comfort, who can console those who feel like they have lost everything. God is a God who feeds the hungry and befriends the lonely. A God who gives hope to the hopeless. A God who gives victory to those who feel defeated and beaten down. When you go to the house of God, you are reminded of this great truth that every death-like experience we have is going to be followed by a resurrection. Suffering leads to glory. Trials lead to maturity. Pain produces perfection. In times of distress, no, there's nothing better to do than to turn to the Lord with all your heart. Run to the Lord. And one of the ways you run to the Lord is by running to his house. Running to his church, gathering with his people. If David could cry out to God in prayer as a man on the run, if David could write psalms in the fires of affliction as a wanted man and as an outlaw, then certainly we can cry out to God as well. Certainly we can sing psalms in the midst of our trials as well. Indeed, the psalms were made for just such occasions because just such occasions produced so many of them. When enemies surround you, when there are fiery trials and obstacles in every direction, God can give you everything you need. God is fully adequate. As he says to Paul, my grace is sufficient. God's gifts, especially the food and the weaponry you get when you come to his house for worship, that's all you need. God's food, God's weaponry. All of us are like David. We're hungry, defenseless beggars. We are beggars in need of bread. And God is happy to supply us. Martin Luther, in his dying words, got it exactly right. He said, we are beggars. It is true. We are beggars in need of heavenly food, heavenly weaponry, and heavenly wisdom. But God delights to give us all these things and so much more. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.